We're continuing in our series on Amos. And so this week we want to consider some of the hard sayings of Amos, hard for us in two ways, sometimes hard academically, sometimes just hard practically. But some of these things are very important for us. The first principle is rather staggering. Last time we got together, we were talking about the first part of that passage that I've placed there for you, chapter 3, verse 3. And today we want to follow up and do the entire section there, because it's one thing after another with Amos sometimes. Just by way of background, remember, Amos is unique because he is the quintessential blue-collar prophet. He says, I was just taking care of the sheep with the other herdmen. I cultivate and pick sycamore trees. I'm not really the prophet or the son of a prophet. I'm just Amos. But then the Lord called him. And so here he is doing what he's not always very comfortable doing. So we come to this section. And chapter 3, verse 3 says, can two walk together except they be agreed? Now, all these questions are rhetorical questions, and you're supposed to say no. So, can two walk together except they be agreed? No. That's just awkward. I mean, why would you want to be with somebody all the time and you just don't want to go to the same places? You don't think the same kind of thoughts. You have very opposite views on all of the important things in life. What breaks your heart doesn't break the other guy's heart. What you dream about is something he would never be interested in doing. Are two people going to be walk together? Are they really going to want to be companions if they really don't see eye to eye on any of the things that are most important and most interesting to them? No, that's awkward. Nobody would ever do that. So verse 4, will a lion roar in the forest when he has no prey? Say no, that'd be a dumb idea. He'll scare away all of his food. So lions that roar because they're in a fight. They're trying to scare somebody, or they roar because they're well fed and they don't care if they scare all the other animals away. But if he's hungry, he's not going to roar. Well, same thing with the next question. Will a young lion cry out of his den if he has taken nothing? Is the young lion going to cry? No, same problem. So verse 5. Can a bird fall in a snare upon the earth where no gin is a snare, is for him? No, if there's no trap, he's not going to fall. He's not going to be trapped. How's that going to work? If you have a little noose on the ground with a piece of twine and you tease him and tempt him to eat something, and you can snatch away the string and lasso his foot, and you've got him, he goes to fly, he can only get 5 feet high, he comes crashing down. Amos says, so if there is no gin, is that going to happen? No, that's dumb. There's no trap. Why would he fall? Well, then the next one, shall a person take up a snare from the earth and have taken nothing at all? No, if there's nothing in the trap, why move it? Don't take it up. Leave it down. Maybe you'll get it next time. So no, knows the answer to all these things. Verse 6, shall a trumpet be blown in the city and the people not be afraid? No, if you hear the sirens, if you hear the alarm, you'll be afraid, of course. You know, that's everybody knows that. So, no, if the trumpet blows, we will be afraid. That's easy. And then the last one, shall there be evil in a city and the Lord hath not done it? You say, well, sure, there's evil that the Lord hasn't done. But wait a minute, all these were no. And so he's, oh, sure. And the answer is supposed to be no again. It's sort of like a trick question. So, yes, the Lord hasn't done evil. Wait a minute. If there's evil, I guess the Lord did do it. I don't know. What's the answer to that question? So you see the bulleted points there, and it's actually a huge thing to grasp in the Christian life. Monumentally important. If you will understand this, it's going to help you through your whole life over and over again. So you see the first bullet there. Does God do evil? Well, he does, in the sense that evil in the Bible is just like the term bad, as in I had a bad day, not necessarily a day characterized by sins. So when you use the word bad, you mean that it wasn't so great. There was suffering, there was hardship, there was frustration. That's bad. But just because there was frustration or hardship or suffering, that doesn't mean that it was evil. So if you say, how was your flight? Ooh, it was a bad flight. You mean the pilot was evil? Do you mean that the plane was evil? What do you mean it's a bad flight? It's not an evil flight. It's not a sinful flight. It's just bad. Well, that's the way the Hebrew word is for bad and evil and all of those things. So now the question isn't, did God do evil? The question is, evil in the sense of sin. The question is, did God do evil in the sense that he brought something bad into your life? And the answer is yes. Although the way Amos asked it, all of these are supposed to be no answers. So it is, shall there be something bad that happens in a city and the Lord hasn't done it? He's supposed to say, no, if there's something bad, the Lord has done it. Like, oh, wow, what a strange doctrine. If you look at the second bullet point there, you're going to see that it's actually very important that we get a handle on this. If there is a hardship, we're not talking now about sin, evil as in wicked. We're talking about something bad. If there is a hardship, not sin, but the effects of sin in the city, as Amos says, or in my life, it is ultimately the work of God. Well, why would God bring something bad into my life? Either to prune me, if I've been doing well already and I can improve, then he'll prune a good fruit tree and have a bigger harvest. That's John 15, right? So either to prune me, that's bad, but it's not evil. It just isn't much fun. Or to chasten me, if I have been behaving badly. So God sends something bad into my life, not sinful into my life. He sends something bad into my life to straighten me out. If I would judge myself, I should not be judged. But I didn't judge myself, so now he has to send something bad into my life. And I don't like that very much. But Amos says, if something bad comes in your life because you've been sinning, didn't God send that? Like, yeah, that's true. God did send that. So either to prune me or to chasten me, or a third possibility, to showcase me to the world. That is, if I can perform well for him now, then it would really be something to see. And so maybe the Lord's going to send something bad in my life to show his glory. I might be rewarded for this. I will be seen as a soldier of valor because I stood when it was not easy to stand. Hudson Taylor, you see that little hollow point there that I provided for you? He thought it was really important for his missionaries to grasp this. And so read that with me. Hudson Taylor appealed to all his missionaries to look past all the second causes of hardship in life and to think of God as the first cause. Now follow his logic here. He said, come joy or come sorrow, we may always take it from the hand of God. Judas betrayed his master with a kiss. Our Lord did not stop short at Judas, nor did he even stop short at the great enemy who filled the heart of Judas to do this thing. But he said, the cup which my Father has given me, shall I not drink it? See, hey, this is all Judas's fault because he betrayed me. Jesus didn't stop there. Oh, no, no, it's Satan's fault because Satan put it in the heart of Judas to betray me. So Satan is the problem. And Jesus didn't stop there. Jesus said, this is the cup that my Father has given me. And you see, if we keep confusing the causes, if we keep saying, oh, this is from the devil, this is from some mean person, and so I'm so frustrated, I'm so exasperated, I'm so beaten down, we have neglected to take the situation to the ultimate truth. That God has sent it. And there are agents in this world who are more than willing to hurt you. But the Lord had to sign off on that. The Lord had to give permission for that. You take a person like Fanny Crosby, who was not born blind, but was blind as a little girl because, maybe because the doctor made a mistake. He put medicine in her eyes and it seems to have caused blindness. You could hate that doctor for the rest of your life for making you go blind. You could, these days, not then, these days, you could sue that doctor. You could punish that doctor. You'll never practice again because he ruined your little girl's eyesight. But you haven't gone back far enough because the first cause, never mind the middle man, the doctor, the first cause in all of that was God, who thought in his wisdom that it might be good for Fanny Crosby to be blind for her entire life, almost. So what do you think about these possibilities that we raise? Pruning, chastening, showcasing. We don't know what God had in mind for Fanny Crosby, but what do you think? Which of those would apply in Fanny's case? Okay, Gloria, you said showcase first. What do you have in mind by that? Yeah, so Gloria's saying we're still telling her story. And all of these perhaps 800 hymns we're singing. And by the way, we always like to notice when we're singing a family Fanny Crosby song, how many times there's a reference to eyesight, vision. When I see his blessed face, it always comes up with her. So it could be showcasing. That would make some sense. Sharla. Yeah. So maybe, remember this morning, it was the same thing. We were talking about Paul, who has a thorn in the flesh, the messenger of Satan, to buffet him so that he doesn't become proud. What if the blindness helps keep Fanny Crosby humble because she always has to ask somebody to help her with one thing or another because she can't transport herself somewhere? Or perhaps she doesn't know exactly where something is in the cupboard and she has to ask for help. What if that's keeping her humble? So in that case, she's already doing a good job, but by pruning her, it's keeping her humble. And so Charlotte says, maybe all of the above. The hardest one might be chastening. I mean, how could we ever know what this chastening looks like? But, you know, that was sort of like Paul's reference again to the thorn in the flesh, the messenger of Satan to buffet him. That was almost like, don't you think that was almost like preventative chastening? I used to tease my boys. I mean, we would never do this, but we said, you know, you're probably going to get a spanking today anyway, so how about if we just do it first thing in the morning and get it over with? Of course, that'd be a very bad idea on every level. But what if it were possible? What if there was a preventative measure that you would take to keep somebody from getting proud, as in Paul's case? So if the Lord, the perfect parent, can prevent us, that's almost like chastening before the fact. And maybe some of that is going on as well. At any rate, one of the most important things you'll ever do when you're in any time of suffering is realize that while the devil is certainly trying to hurt you, walking about as a roaring lion, sure, and while there are many, many mean people in the world who are trying to hurt you, none of that is possible unless the Lord decides to allow a break in the fence of his protection so that the devil or this mean person can do this. And if the Lord says, all right, let's go ahead and, you know, let the force field down for a moment, it's the Lord who's deciding that. And you can rest in that. The Lord is interested in showcasing you in battle. So that means you have to go to battle. If you don't like battle, then you can never be showcased. Then the Lord would like to showcase you in battle and give you rewards for doing well. And the Lord would like to prune you, even if you are great. You know, you're doing a good job, good harvest this past season. Now, let's cut you back, and next season you'll even do better. So, but if you say, no, Lord, you have to keep that protective coating around me at all times. Don't ever let anything bad happen to me. You can never be showcased. You can never be pruned for improvement. And, of course, chastisement. You get what you deserve. Angie. Angie is mentioning, you know, agents. Does God need a middleman? And, of course, he doesn't. Actually, in the John 15 text, it's the Lord himself doing the pruning. He doesn't have the devil doing it specifically or a mean person doing it. The Lord himself is doing it. And in the letters to the seven churches, Laodicea, chapter 3, Revelation, as many as I love, I rebuke and chasten. So there doesn't need to be a middleman. But certainly there is no problem to introduce the middleman because the Lord is in control of all the middlemen as much as, you know, his own hands. So there is no problem in doing that. But you will wear yourself out when you're in hardship if you keep saying, that guy, he did this to me, that guy. And it's not necessary for you to go there. You go another step back and say, and behind all of that, the Lord took down the fence in that place so that I could finally have a battle, so that I could finally be pruned back and really become something. And as long as you keep saying that guy, you are overlooking what might have been good in this and what the Lord intended all along. Does that raise any other questions, Teresa, or observations? Teresa is saying that when hardship comes, let's say that an individual person has harmed you and you can put a face on that harm, it seems a lot more excusable spiritually to say, I'm mad at you, than to look over his head and say, I'm mad at God. And you think, oh, I don't think I'm supposed to be mad at God. That's not very good, is it? And so instead of going there and dealing with the first cause, the Lord himself, we're content to say, I'm mad at you. And you can justify that all day long. But if you're going to be mad at God, now you're saying, oh, okay, well, either God is not smart and he really messed up this one. When I get to heaven, I'm going to correct him big time, tell him how foolish he was in this mistake. Or if God is smart, then God's not really very kind. And when I get to heaven, I'm going to say, well, I don't think you're very kind. And of course, that's ridiculous. We know we're never going to say that. So instead of facing the issue here, we put another human face on and say, that guy right there, he's the trouble. And we haven't understood the truth of it, that was your chance to showcase your spiritual depth or to be pruned so you come back better next season. And you don't want to overlook that. That's the big thing in life. That's not a little thing. That's the big thing. And you really want to do that well. Tom, even mainstream hyper-Calvinism would not assign sin to God. Now, there might be some individuals who do that. Certainly atheists, people who are attacking our side, will say, well, true or false, God created everything. True. So if God created everything, then God created sin. See? Can't miss. And even a mainstream hyper-Calvinist wouldn't say that. That's what the enemies of the faith say. So even a mainstream hyper-Calvinist would never say that. A mainstream would never say that. There might be individuals who say that. And, you know, that's a bit of a puzzle. Deep down, and I have heard my seminary professors along the way say, actually, we don't exactly know how it is that God could create everything and not be responsible for the bad things, the evil, sinful things that are happening in the world. All we can say is that the Bible always assigns blame to Satan and humans and never to God. As for how God can create everything and not have any blame, we don't actually know how that would work. It has something to do with the Lord creating individuals who have free will, and they're not automatons. Somehow, even though he created it all, he doesn't get any blame for the sin that happens. And it's one of those things you just have to take by faith. We don't know why God doesn't have any blame for this. But truly, I guess we have free will, and Satan had free will, so the Lord's not going to take any blame for it. And all we can do is say, well, it's the way the Bible reads. So here we are. Sharla. Absolutely. And Hudson Taylor's illustration is very nice this way, because you see, it's not like Judas got a free pass, right? So he is miserable. He hangs himself. The rope breaks. His guts splatter in the field. And Peter says he went to his own place, clearly hell. It's not like he got a free pass because, you know, the Father gave Jesus that cup. So it is necessary that offenses will come, but woe to the man by whom they come. And so, yes, that guy who hurt you, who intentionally hurt you, he is going to be dealt with by God in some way that God sees fit either in time or in eternity. But we don't have to get stuck on that. So that's between that guy and God. And then we have a relationship with the Lord. And we don't necessarily want to think that that fellow gets off. I mean, that's not true. We know. Vengeance is mine. I will repay, saith the Lord. So you just don't worry about it. You know, I've got this. But that doesn't mean that he gets a free pass. So we have to trust the Lord to handle all those things. Kathy. I think that's very important. You want to maintain genuine human and even angelic free will so that the individual, you know, there's some risk to God creating creatures with free will. And he thought it was worth that risk. So you get what you get in the Garden of Eden and elsewhere. Marie and then John. I'm sorry, John. Very good. Yes, Joseph is a great example of that. Thank you for mentioning that. John. Yeah, John is talking about the man born blind, which I think you had for a Sunday school lesson in Rod's class. And, you know, God intervened evidently directly twice at his birth so that he'd be born blind and then at his healing. And so God took matters directly into his own hands without any middleman. So in that case, he controlled it directly. Good. And I missed somebody else. Josiah. Yeah. Yeah, that's right. When we use the term risk, how do we say that God was ever at risk? Mike. Yeah. And that whole thing of even now, you know, grieve not the Spirit of God. So it is possible for God to experience grief because of what we're doing. Very unusual thing to ponder. Pat. Yeah. So here's a practical example. You're sitting in a traffic jam when you're late for an appointment and you feel like you could explode. I hate being late for appointments. Maybe it's even something that would have repercussions on your career, something like this. I hate being late. And you're just so upset. I can't believe that this has happened. All right. So work through the possibilities. This is a hardship. You know, is there evil in the city and the Lord hasn't sent it? This is a hardship. So how does this work in my life? Number one, maybe it is some sort of an opportunity for you to be pruned and do better next time. You know what? It is silly that I have made it a characteristic in my life to time everything to the last minute. In the future, I think I would rather be 20 minutes early than 5 minutes late and make everybody mad at me. This is the day I change, and I'm not going to press it anymore. See, that'd be an excellent thing. That might help you many, many times in your life. And then if you have a traffic jam, it's not a felony. It's like, no big deal. I'm in a traffic jam. That happens. So maybe this prunes you. And next time, you're going to be a different person. You turn over a new leaf and you've learned a lesson. Maybe it is something to showcase what God's people can do in a time of hardship. Even like, let us say it affects your career. There's nothing more that I can do. I fall into the hands of God. Lord, save my career. Or don't. I don't know anything else humanly that I was supposed to be doing. I see the possibility here. I fall into your hands. And all of the angels of heaven and the angels who serve hell are watching to see what a Christian behaves like when his job is on the line in a traffic jam. So show them what a Christian behaves like. Do something that is reward worthy forever and do it right. So when you come to the little things in life or the big, I mean, if you've been paralyzed in a car accident, same thing. All right. Is there anything that I'm going to improve in my life because of this? Am I going to showcase what it's like to be a paraplegic for Jesus and all of heaven and hell? Look on. Show them what you're made of. Be great for Jesus. And that is going to preserve your sanity. The other possibility is you get mad at the car manufacturer because he didn't give you a capsule of safety when you crashed, or you get mad at the guy who hit you and you go through your life in bitterness. You just have to step away from all that and say, I believe in God. It must be that he took away the protective wall in this one place at this one time so I could show the world what a Christian is in this circumstance. And just do it. And it is a lot more comforting to think that you're falling into the hands of God than you're falling into the hands of chance and car accidents and mean people and the devil. There's no comfort in that. Falling into the hands of God, we can live with that because God will always love us and God will always be smart. We can live with that. Nancy? Yes, that's great. That's right. I read sometime back and I have a hard time getting the details. It was a very short account in a book of many accounts, and somebody just sort of mentioned it in passing. But there's this great story about a castle that was under siege, and one of the royal family's most loyal knights raced into the castle on his horse, into the courtyard, grabbed up the little royal princess girl and scooped her up. I mean, this is a matter of life and death. And he grabbed her under one arm and kicked his horse and was riding furiously at breakneck speed to get out of this castle courtyard. And this little girl did not want to leave the castle courtyard. And while this knight is saving her life, she is pounding on him with her fist and kicking at him and saying, "Let go, let go." And he's saving her life. If the Lord decides to make you a paraplegic, you don't need to pound on him with your fists and kick at him and say, "Leave me alone, leave me alone." He's probably saving your life in some way that you had never imagined. As long as you think, "Oh, this bad guy has me," then you're going to hate it. If you think, "Oh, God has me," then that's a whole different hardship. Everything is different because of that. So Amos said, "Is it possible that there's going to be evil in this city and the Lord hasn't sent it?" No, he's in control. Relax. As long as God loves you and God is smart, relax. You're going to be okay. Josiah. Well, okay, so look at the next thing there. I don't have very much on this point, but I thought it was very colorful, very powerful, dramatic. From chapter 3, verse 8, Amos says, "The lion has roared. Who will not fear? The Lord God has spoken. Who can but prophesy?" Prophesy meaning repeat what the Lord tells you to say. It's supernatural revelation. But I love that because it pictures God as roaring. And remember, we said the lion doesn't roar when he's sneaking up on the gazelle. That'd be crazy. He roars when he has a full belly, when he's challenged, when he has to fight. So this is picturing the Lord roaring like a lion. Is God a lion that roars? Is that politically correct? Are we allowed to say, you know, the God we worship is a lion who roars? I mean, what fraction of American people want to worship a lion who roars? But that's what Amos says. God is like the lion who roars. And if God has spoken, how can I not prophesy? He told me to do this. The lion is roaring. You think I'm going to say no? I just think that's so lost on our current generation that God is like a roaring lion. He is not a pushover. He's not a baby. God is a roaring lion. And Amos said, "Now, if God decides to roar, don't you think you better be afraid?" Everybody says, "Oh, never say that you should fear God. Don't say you're afraid of God." Amos doesn't say that. Amos says, "The lion has roared. Who will not fear?" I would say, well, fear doesn't really mean fear. If a lion roars at you, do you think you might have real fear or will it just be respect? Well, I really respect you, Mr. Lion. I think we're going to be afraid. And God is a lion that roars in Amos's perspective. And I think that's not politically correct. But I think spiritually, if you have no true fear of God, I do not want to get crossways with God. I don't even want to think about getting crossways with God. Then you don't live right. So I thought that was very interesting. Does that raise any questions or observations? Amy. That's right. Yeah, he's not a tame lion, you know. C.S. Lewis told us. God is not a tame lion, you know. So that's right. The third subheading you have there. Am I really ready for the day of the Lord? It includes terror, you know. And by the way, this is very similar to what Joel said. So if you remember when we studied Joel a few weeks back. So chapter 5, verse 18. woe unto you. Remember that word woe is like pain. If somebody stomps on your toe, you might say, oh, whoa, that just hurts. And that's what we're trying to describe here. Woe unto you that desire the day of the Lord. To what end is it for you? The day of the Lord is darkness and not light, as if a man did flee from a lion and a bear met him, or went into the house and leaned his hand on the wall and a serpent bit him. Shall not the day of the Lord be darkness and not light, even very dark and no brightness in it? So again, remember the day of the Lord, like any good Jewish day. It's going to start with nighttime, right? The evening and the morning were the first day. So always evening first. The day starts at supper time, 6 o'clock in the evening, sundown. So you go to night first. That's what we call the tribulation. And then comes morning, sunshine, everything better. That's what we call the millennium. But you start with the tribulation and then the millennium. And the tribulation is dark, very dark. Amos says, are you sure you want this? You know, it does have terror to it. Are you prepared for the day of the Lord, when the Lord comes? Are you prepared for that? Maybe to you, there needs to be some recalibration, because the Lord comes with judgment and you are the object of judgment. So you say, won't it be great when the Lord comes, the day of the Lord? Well, not if you're the object of the Lord's judgment. That's not great. Same thing in chapter 8, verse 9. It shall come to pass in that day, the day of the Lord, saith the Lord God, that I will cause the sun to go down at noon. These are tribulational cosmic disturbances. I will darken the earth in the clear day. I will turn your feasts into mourning and all your songs into lamentation. I will bring up sackcloth upon all loins and baldness upon every head. A little note there, they shave their heads, remember, as a sign of trauma, something like when it's done for a Nazirite, when he's showing his devotion in a Nazirite vow. He says, I will make it as the mourning of an only son. When you have just one son and he dies, that is like the day of the Lord. So Amos says, are you sure that you want to face the Lord? Are you prepared to face the Lord? Because you are an object of judgment. You're not ready for this. And so that's very good to be reminded of. We say we want Jesus to come back. Well, definitely we want Jesus to come back. But even when we're talking about the rapture, are you ready for that? Do you want Jesus to come back, meaning that you have all the rewards you want now? You have, as Jesus said, finished the work that the Father gave you to do. You're done? If we put your works in the crucible and set it on fire, you'll do okay? You want Jesus to come back? Or was there something else you still wanted to do before the rapture? And if there's something you still want to do, this would be an excellent time to get busy. Does that raise any questions or observations before we leave that? All right, so one more point at the bottom. Amos is talking about hypocrisy in the worship. So chapter 5, verse 21, the Lord, speaking through Amos, says, I hate, I despise your feast days, and I will not smell in your solemn assemblies. Though you offer me burnt offerings and your meat offerings, I will not accept them. Neither will I regard the peace offerings of your fat beasts. Take thou away from me the noise of thy songs, for I will not hear the melody of the viols. But let judgment run down as waters, righteousness as a mighty stream. Have you offered unto me sacrifices and offerings in the wilderness 40 years, O house of Israel? But you have borne the tabernacle of your Moloch and Chion. That should be Chion. These are probably references to the false god Saturn. Your images, the star of your God. Star is a symbol, which is why a lot of Bible students are a little uncomfortable with the Star of David as a symbol for Israel. They had a star. The star of your God, which you made to yourselves. Therefore, will I cause you to go into captivity beyond Damascus. That's the Assyrian captivity, saith the Lord, whose name is the God of hosts. That's really interesting that the Lord has such hard words against hypocritical worship. So when he says, I hate this, I despise this, it actually makes the Lord viscerally, emotionally disgusted that these people would be doing their worship. And it's really interesting. You see in verse 23, I've underlined there for you. Take away from me the noise of the songs. Why are you singing? I don't want to hear this. Take this away. And we forget that the Lord, the simplest worship, I always think, you know, here's this young mother rocking her baby in the bedroom, middle of the night because the baby's not sleeping. But this mother, this young mother is rocking her baby and humming a little song of praise to the Lord, thankful that she has this little baby. That's true worship. I think that is so sweet. It's so simple, but true worship. And yet, if you have, dare we say it on tape, the Mormon Tabernacle Choir, all those voices in the air, instruments, and while they sing their songs, in their heart of hearts, they're thinking, the God we serve is just one God, an entire council of gods. The Jesus we're singing about is brother to Lucifer. I think, wow, well, that Tabernacle Choir music, that was really something, wasn't it? Like, no, not really. That wasn't something. What was really something is that young mother tipping back and forth in the rocking chair, thankful for her little baby in the middle of the night, humming a little song. That's music. That's beautiful. And we sometimes get it all backwards, and the Lord doesn't want us to get it backwards. Well, does that raise any questions or observations, Josiah? Yeah, that's beautiful. The broken and contrite heart will not be despised. All of those other trappings and externals were actually despised. Tom, I don't think I would make very much distinction. Maybe there is, but what do you think? Two things come to mind as you talk like that. The first thing is that there are... you know, if we start with the idea that offering our bodies the living sacrifices are reasonable and continuous service, there are times necessarily when we are not giving the Lord our undivided attention. For example, when I'm at work trying to solve a computer problem and it's making me crazy, it's too hard for me, I'm not giving God my undivided attention. And to make matters worse, here's the second thing. Even when I come to church, I am not righteous enough to give God my undivided attention. In my whole life, have I really ever given God my undivided attention? They say I can think 600 words a minute, but speaking quickly, I would only speak 150 words a minute. So theoretically, I can listen to your 150 words or even say my own 150 words and at the same time be planning what I'm going to say next or even thinking about something entirely different. So am I righteous enough, saintly enough, that in my whole life I've ever given God my undivided attention? So God is used to people not giving him undivided attention. As a matter of fact, we might not even be, there might not ever have been men or even moments when God had undivided attention. And that's just human. So if we relate it to other relationships, if all day, every day, I'm presenting myself to the Lord as a living sacrifice, the Lord does want me to earn a living for my family. So that is his will. And I am presenting myself to do that part of my day. But what you're saying that resonates with me is what if, in a marriage, for example, Teresa doesn't expect me when I'm here at the church office to be giving her my undivided attention. I do give her my attention, though. I think of her quite a lot, even when I'm in the church office. But what if actually I never really did give her that much attention? Didn't even really concentrate on giving her that much attention. So that I think, you know, I've gone really days without pulling up the chairs and really talking. I could have gone on a little bike ride with her and chatted about things. I mean, there was nothing really keeping me from doing that. I just didn't. So in our relationship with the Lord, what if, truth to tell, we didn't really bother with God that much on Monday or Tuesday or Wednesday. We finally get to a Sunday. We don't really bother with God that much even when we're at church. We're still not really trying to express ourselves to Him. I think that would be a pretty big problem. So there are lots of layers of attention that we give God. If you're never really into God, I think that's a pretty big problem. And that might be hypocrisy. But yeah, that's a really good soul-searching kind of question. Rob? Yeah, so Rob is saying if we're listening to music being performed by people who maybe are even hostile to God, you know, what if Messiah is being performed by the local symphony and they don't even like Messiah? I mean, the person Messiah. What's really interesting about that, Rob, here's what I would suggest. So, or let's go back to the Mormon Tabernacle Choir. So they're singing something, Let's Make It How Great Thou Art. So I'm listening to that. And while I listen to that, I'm thinking, how great thou art, Lord. I mean, you really are great. Well, it's worship to me. I don't know what they're doing. That's between them and the Lord. But I know when I am thinking the Lord is great, that's my worship. So I wouldn't worry too much about what the performers think if it's worship in your intention and your, you know, in your heart of hearts. Then I think that gives glory to God. So that's what I would say. What do you think of that? Well, if you couldn't hear Rob, he's talking about people on the platform. What if they're trying to lead in worship and they themselves are not fit to lead in worship? That switches gears a little bit because now we are meeting in the context of encouraging as closely as we can undivided attention to God. So it is common for churches to have musicians up there. I mean, I had a friend whose organist was a homosexual, and he played for the songs like, you know, $1 million. And when it came time for the preaching, he just got up and left, and they paid him for his services. Well, if you are in the context of encouraging undivided attention to the Lord, then you would want people on the platform who are sympathetic to that goal. If they don't have a heart for that, then they shouldn't be up there. That being said, what Bible teacher or pastor is up there with a perfect heart toward God? You know, so you have the same problem anytime anyone tries to lead anything in the Christian life. Imperfect or none are your choices there. No perfect.